Hi, this is Meredith Irvine, editor of CompensationStandards.com. Welcome to the Pay and Proxy podcast. Today, I'm very happy to welcome Paul Hodgson of S-Gage. Paul, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure.
So Paul is here to discuss the recent Delaware Chancery Court's decision in Turnetta v. Musk, which of course involved Tesla shareholders' legal challenge to Elon Musk's 2018 equity award, which probably most of our listeners know is the largest pay package in public company history. This opinion is a very lengthy 200 pages, opens with the question, was the richest person in the world overpaid? Paul is going to just really quickly cover the key points of this case and then focus today on some of the really key takeaways for compensation committees and the folks who advise them. I'd say this opinion kind of presents us with a good outline of steps that need to be followed when setting compensation generally, but in particular, some of the facts of the case are present. For example, if a recipient is potentially a controlling shareholder or a so-called superstar CEO, or the grant is a moonshot or mega grant type of award. Before we get into the substance today, Paul, can you just start by sharing with our listeners a little bit about your background and a little bit about S-Gage?
Yeah, so I've been working in compensation, particularly in ESG more generally, for over 35 years. I've worked for a number of different outfits, research outfits, including the corporate library. And at the moment, I'm senior advisor to S-Gage, which is a data house based in New Delhi in India. And we maintain data sets on executive compensation, director compensation, shareholder voting, board practices, including things like which committees are responsible for overseeing ESG risk, CEO profiles. We have data on CEO succession practices, environmental disclosures, which are now becoming much more open and are about to get even more open with the SEC ruling, and human capital management and social disclosures as well, which again have been expanding in scope over the last 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely perfect. Thank you for that overview. And just for listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with the facts of this case, can you start with some background and in particular describe the compensation package that was at issue?
Oh, sure. So it was an award in 2018. It was described as a one of a kind in corporate history, but actually it's two of a kind because it's almost exactly the same as the compensation package he awarded himself back in 2012. Slightly fewer options, slightly less value because the company was worth less at that time, but it's basically the same package. It was a grant of 12 performance-based stock options. Each grant, each tranche was equal to 1% of outstanding stock at the time. It had a grant date market value of $2.3 billion, although the proxy also said that it might be worth $55 or $58 million. I forget what the precise number is, but they were upfront about that. The performance conditions for the award were 12 market capitalization milestones. Basically, he had to raise the market cap of Tesla by $50 billion for each tranche to vest. And then they were also based on 16 other performance milestones. Eight of them were revenue targets and eight were based on adjusted EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. So that was it. Most of the operational milestones were substantially met by September 2022, which indicates that they weren't particularly challenging. The stock price has been going up and down quite substantially. So some of the market cap milestones have not been met so far, but since the pay package has been rescinded, they're not relevant anymore.
And so, Paul, when you mentioned the maximum value, if all those operational metrics were achieved and
exactly.
All the market cap metrics were achieved, that was somewhere around
$58 billion. Yes.
Total value.
Yeah. Yeah. And at one time, it was estimated to be $55.6 billion. I think that was the maximum at the time of court case.
Okay. So it has some precedent within Tesla, but a very unprecedented dollar amount.
We can cover that when you ask me the question about the comp committee comparators.
Perfect. And then just a little bit about the legal challenge to the comp package. So can you talk about the legal basis that was claimed here and then how the Chancery Court ended up applying entire fairness and deciding the defendants had the burden of proof there?
Well, the primary consequence of her finding, and I'll give you a quote from Chancellor McCormick because it says it much more elegantly than I would be able to. So the primary consequence is that the defendants bore the burden of proving at trial that the compensation plan was entirely fair. But the defendants were unable to prove that the stockholder vote was fully informed because the proxy statement inaccurately described key directors as independent and misleadingly omitted details about the process, like omitting details about the fact that Elon came to us and asked us to give him this compensation package, and we said yes. That wasn't in the proxy statement, for example. But I think what her decision was based on was the fact that the directors, when they stood up in court and tried to justify the process that they used to establish the compensation package, was deeply flawed and was not conducted independently and was not conducted in a manner that you would expect a large public company to go about deciding pay decisions like that.
That's right. And we'll go kind of in our subsequent questions through what a good process looks like based on some of the takeaways from the case. I think it's worth noting that the big reason we were in entire fairness in this case is because there was ultimately Chancellor McCormick decided that Musk was a controlling shareholder for purposes of this award. What took them out of the business judgment rule and ultimately ended in applying entire fairness?
When I first wrote about this back in 2018, I was writing for a magazine called Responsible Investor in the UK. And my initial reaction to the news that Tesla was going to give Musk over 20 million stock options was, what on earth does someone who already owns over 36 million shares, like 22% of the company, why does he need more shares? That was my first reaction. And just sitting back and looking, I mean, she does make that point very clearly in the judgment. What incentive did you hope to provide to this man who owns 22% of the company, which is not a controlling shareholding, but it's a very substantial one?
Right, right. And she, you know, in the Delaware Chancery Court had the question of whether he was a controlling shareholder up in front of them in the past. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of able to answer without answering that question.
Right.
And ultimately, Chancellor McCormick here had to address that and did determine that he was, at least with respect to this grant. Okay. So let's kind of go into some of our practical takeaways for compensation committees and the folks who advise compensation committees. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the independence issues here. Can you kind of describe some of the relationships that Chancellor McCormick took issue with and give us some thoughts on how boards should approach those types of issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think some major governance concerns of Tesla anyway. And one of the problems with independence that she found that was a very concrete one was the fact that the board that earned $735 million between 2017 and 2020, a director pay package of an order of Elon Musk's, in fact. And that was subject to another court challenge, in fact, and the court again found against Tesla, and the directors had to return that money and agree to take no fees for the next 3 years. So if you're paying your directors that much money, it just undermines your ability to act independently and to say no to your CEO who's asking you to pay them very, very large amounts of money. So that's one of the main problems. The other ones, two members of the compensation committee, they determined had very long and deep personal ties with Musk going back to 15 to 20 years. One of them regularly went on family vacations with his family and Musk's family, and was also a very major investor in every single one of Musk's activities. So I saw one commentator saying, it's a good idea to have at least one independent director on the compensation committee. I'm like, one? I think most people would consider it highly irregular if there weren't four. The whole committee was independent. But anyway, I'll just throw that in there. But one of the things that the Chancellor said was that independence must be considered as a concept, not just a box-checking exercise. Well, it's not somebody that works for the company, it's et cetera, et cetera. All of the rules that the SEC and the exchanges have put out there about independence, you know, you can check all those boxes and still have a deeply compromised director whose independence can be challenged, as was in the court case, you know, very, very clearly and very openly. I was just looking back at the kind of history of governance concerns there. There was a 2017 shareholder resolution to declassify the board from the state of Connecticut. They were saying that the board at that time was basically the same board that led the IPO in 2007, rather. And the board still has not changed very much since then. There have been engagements from very large shareholders like CalSTRS, the NYC controller, pleading with the board to put more independent directors on there. Basically, six of the nine directors are considered non-independent, some because they just have a long tenure, it's in excess of 10 years, because they've been there since the IPO, but others for close business ties, like the two on the compensation committee. So there's a lot of concerns there about the board's independence and its ability to act independently. So that was a big part of the case.
Yeah, I'm really glad you highlighted the director compensation piece of it, because I don't think many boards really consider how much your director pay package is challenging the independence of your directors. Now, These were some pretty specific circumstances.
Yeah.
But kind of understand if you have market cap that increases so rapidly over a short period of time, that mm-hmm. that drastically changes the generational wealth of one of your directors.
Yeah.
This case says that's a consideration.
Right.
Well, perfect. So let's move on to some of the issues with the negotiation and the approval process. Can you kind of walk us through some of the process takeaways for compensation committees here?
The judgment basically outlined a process where she was like a self-drive negotiation process, I think she called it, because she was having fun. And basically, as it seems from the disclosures that were made during the case itself, Musk went to the compensation committee and said, this is the package that I want. And then there was a whole series of emails and exchanges and documents that had Musk negotiating almost with himself rather than with the committee, not asking the committee's approval for certain changes, certain emendations, changes to performance conditions, and so on and so forth. So this whole process was, as she said, self-driven. It wasn't the compensation committee sitting down on its own, independently, coming up with a pay package, presenting it to Musk, and then saying, what do you think about this? We're going to present it to the rest of the board to get their approval. It was entirely the opposite way around. That happens when you have, what does she call him, a paradigmatic superstar CEO? When you have somebody like that, and then you get a reversal of the negotiation process. At the start of my writing about US companies back in 2000, when I moved here, Jack Welch was doing it at GE. You know, and this was before all the governance reforms that we've seen so far, you know, before compensation committees, before all sorts of things happened. So it was less surprising then, although not particularly good governance or not particularly very ethical, but it was less surprising then because we didn't have these checks and balances in place. Now, all of the checks and balances are still voluntary. They're not obligatory. So people do ignore them and will continue to until it's made law or until you get cases like this, which actually say, No, you can't do that. So that process is a kind of an old-fashioned approach to compensation negotiations by CEOs, especially ones who are very powerful and very influential.
And I thought it was interesting how much the opinion focused on the timeline and who controlled the timeline. You know, Chancellor McCormick really took issue with the fact that Musk laid out a very aggressive timeline initially. And it was extended, but it was not extended at the compensation committee. It was just because Musk asked for more time. And again, it was a negotiating self sort of situation. So
yeah,
that's another thing. I think compensation committees do find themselves sometimes in the position of a CEO trying to dictate a comp timeline. But clearly this opinion kind of says, no, the compensation committee should be taking the reins and saying, this is how much time we need to deliberate. This is the information, you know, be asking for additional information, be setting out their own timeline and having even the timeline be a negotiation, not just the substance of the pay package.
Yeah. And there was one other thing she said that was about the level of care taken writing documents and emails was another thing that she brought up. So like these are corporate documents. There shouldn't be jokes in them unless they're not business emails. There was just a level of lack of awareness of what proper business behavior is from both the board and Musk. And she was very concerned about that and was quite stern in passing judgment on the kind of behavior that was clearly behind the sorts of words that were used in those documents, those emails.
And I think, you know, one of the other things that she pointed out was the underutilizing the outside advisors on the company. I think there was an interesting, you know, it's not enough to have those outside advisors if you're not asking them to challenge your thinking, if you're not asking them to provide benchmarking. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons given that benchmarking wasn't asked requested here.
Yeah.
But it seems like she took issue with the amount that management members were being utilized to provide information versus the outside consultants who were engaged but weren't necessarily doing as much as they could have been doing to support the process.
Right. Well, I mean, the judgment actually says that the board disregarded the advice of their compensation consultant, which they name as Compensia, because the consultant raised concerns about the size of the package and the timeline of the options. I mean, not only did they fail to do a benchmarking study, which would have exposed how out of whack the pay was, they just ignored the advice of the compensation consultant. I mean, she says what she said that was an outlier by orders of magnitude, noting that the package was 250 times larger than the median peer compensation plan and over 33 times larger than the plan's closest comparison, which happened to be Musk's 2011 compensation package was the closest one. So, I mean, I pulled some stats from SKH for an earlier podcast that showed that the next most highly paid CEO in that year earned $300 million, which is still pretty substantial, but it's not of the orders of billions. But the median pay of even the largest companies, those with revenues of $50 billion, was $19 million. That was the median. So any kind of benchmarking study that was put together would have exposed the orders of magnitude outlierdom of this package.
And, you know, one of the arguments made at trial was this package isn't quite as abnormal in the private equity world, which Chancellor McCormick quickly pushed that to the side. I think there might be some circumstances where private equity might use this kind of package, where that might be something compensation committees actually are considering if there's a reason to do so. But if that's the case, you know, that needs to be clear that compensation committees are benchmarking against private equity held companies have a reason to be doing that and make that clear in the documentation of the process.
Yeah. Although there's not very good disclosure about what goes on in pay for private company executives. So it's going to be, it would be difficult to conduct something like that, benchmarking study like that. So that's it's like little bits just kind of leak out every now and then about, you know, what somebody's earned at, you know, XYZ private company. But the amount of information out there to construct a data set like that will be very difficult, I think.
That's very true. Yes, good point. And then one of the things that Tesla kind of sought to do, I think partially to protect from a litigation scenario, kind of in addition to getting the required shareholder approval, they sought to get this majority, the minority shareholder approval. But ultimately, you know, as you noted up front, Chancellor McCormick decided that that was not effective to, you know, accomplish the intended burden shifting. So if companies are in a position where they do want to go out and seek shareholder approval of a compensation package, with that in mind, kind of what should they do to make sure that that actually accomplishes the intended objective?
They have to sit down with their largest shareholders and discuss it. I mean, that's as simple as that. It's really not difficult. I mean, there are the largest shareholders in Tesla, apart from Musk himself, it's the same everywhere else. It's Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same group of Fidelity as well, I think, but it's the same group of mega shareholders in this country. And they regularly sit down with companies. They have engagement processes. Most companies are now disclosing their shareholder engagement processes, and this often includes CEO compensation and executive compensation more generally. So that kind of puts you in a position to knowing where your largest shareholders are going to place their vote. Are they going to support or not support? You know, Musk hates proxy advisors as well, and both of them advise shareholders to vote against this package, unsurprisingly, because they will have done their own peer comparisons and realized that this is not a pay package, but this is a Mars-based pay package rather than an Earth-based one. So interestingly, he and his brother decided not to cast their shares as a vote in the approval process. So if there was some shareholder kickback at the time and got a majority of the vote, but as the chancellor said, and I said at the beginning, you know, the details of the plan were not clear enough for shareholders to make an informed decision. And I think that's it. So it's sitting down with your shareholders and also being open and concrete and concise and clear about what the plan actually is and does.
Yeah, I thought it was important to note that she, you know, kind of said it's not just the economics, because part of the argument kind of made in the lawsuit was, well, the economics were fully disclosed and the economics were approved. And I think she kind of said, no, there's information that extends beyond the economics that's important. Right. So things like the conflicts, the process that she found were lacking. And, you know, they did give information on conflicts. They did give information on process. But then she also seemed to say that, well, they decided to speak on those topics, but then the coverage of those topics, maybe she thought, wasn't full and fair going through everything that should be addressed when you're speaking on those topics.
Yeah, I think she found it inadequate. I think that wasn't enough information for people to make an informed decision.
And in particular, I think she noted that they did not say that they didn't pursue a traditional benchmarking analysis, which I thought that was interesting to call out as an omission. If you don't do benchmarking, you should be saying in your proxy statement that you didn't engage in benchmarking analysis.
Right, because they have a compensation peer group. I mean, it's not like they don't have one, but yes, it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It may have come into play for the other executives, but not for Musk himself.
Right, right. Well, Paul, thanks so much. I think this was a really fun discussion, a very interesting topic, lots of practical takeaways for compensation committees. I appreciate everyone listening in. That concludes our podcast.
Okay, bye-bye.